I want to talk about the need for food and you know, obviously very, very core to why we're all here, but also talk about how Monsanto is participating in helping to feed the planet for the future. Really, food security, food sovereignty is a huge issue that faces the planet today, and as I'll show you, it's going to grow even more within the future. And how we do this sustainably, I think, is going to be something that's going to be critical, and there are different definitions of what sustainable agriculture means. But obviously producing more with less is going to be absolutely critical to us. And you know, one comment that I would make to start with today, we just announced this morning that we have a collaboration with BASF on bringing additional herbicide-tolerant traits to the marketplace. Dicamba is the gene that we're working with. And the announcement today was that there's been really good progress that's been made in some new innovative formulations to go over the top with the Roundup Ready technology we have in the place today. So, you know, again, sustainable solutions mean multi-gene products so that farmers can continue to use these tools sustainably well into the future. So, you know, what's the need? Well, you know, the year before I was born, 1960, you know, about 1 acre of land per person is what it took to feed the planet. It's now up to about 1.8, and it's going to need to go between 2.4 and 2.6 people per acre. If we're going to feed this planet long term. And it's just pretty simple math, right? I mean, there's two ways we can do it. We can either go try and find more land, which of course is becoming increasingly scarce. I mean, the cities in this country, you know, we're located kind of where the best farm ground was. So unless we're going to tear down our cities and basically start farming that ground again, we're going to have to increase the productivity of what we do. And not only in this country, but in the emerging markets as well. So world population growth, right? This is 50% of the demand equation as we look at it for the long term. And if you look at where we're going to be by 2030, we are going to grow the equivalent of about two more Indias, okay, by 2030. A couple billion more mouths to feed on the planet. And so again, how we do that sustainably is core to what you all do every day. And it's going to be something that's going to be an increasing challenge for us as we look to the future. But what's really interesting is that's, as I said, only 50% of the demand equation. As incomes rise, okay, we just don't aspire to eat grain. We like to eat things that eat grain, okay, protein. And so the relevance of that is if you think about the first $10,000 of GDP growth. So if I become employed, if I enter the workforce and I begin to generate income, the first thing that I aspire to do is I like to eat meat. And the slope of that line for the first $10,000 of GDP, I mean, it's almost vertical. Slope's almost one, okay? And then you can see how it really, really flattens out over time. United States, if you look at what our protein demand is gonna do, it's largely just driven by population growth. We earn enough money that we're eating about all the meat that we're gonna eat, you know, so as our incomes rise, it doesn't mean demand's gonna grow. But if you look at places like India, like China, you're seeing a huge, huge increase. And obviously, when you've got, you know, 1.1 billion people in India, 1.3 billion in China, that magnifies pretty, pretty quickly. The relevance of it is, if I used to eat grain and today I'm going to eat poultry, it takes about 2 pounds of grain to produce a pound of poultry. If I'm going to eat pork, it takes about 3 pounds of grain to produce that pound of pork. And if I'm going to eat beef, it's about 6 to 8 pounds of grain to produce that pound of beef. So a huge, huge multiplier effect. And I mean, it's really interesting. I was visiting in Beijing with a couple of Chinese economists and talking about economic development within the country. And it was really interesting. I also read a translation or synopsis of the last party Congress statements. And China said basically three things. Their economic development exceeded even what their wildest expectations were. Fabulous success. But the environmental cost of the growth was untenable, and that had to be addressed long term. And the third point was the disparate income between the rural poor and the urban wealthy was something that needed to be addressed. So I'm visiting with these economists and we're talking about it, and they said, well, basically the plan for the next 10 years was they were going to relocate about 300 million people from the interior of the country to the coast. I said, whoa, I mean, biggest migration in the history of humanity. I mean, and I said, okay, well, now when they get to the coast and they get jobs, what are they going to eat? I mean, how are you going to feed these people? You know, they're already net importer now of both corn and soybeans. And the one economist said, well, it's quite simple. We're all just going to eat less. And the other economist looked at him and said, no, we're not. No, we're gonna eat more. So again, it's just the criticality of just the magnitude of the task of what it's gonna take to feed this planet going forward. So really, if you think about, you know, we're gonna have to double the amount of food and fiber we're gonna produce on the planet, and about 50% of it's just purely a function of more mouths to feed on the planet, and about the other half of it is dietary changes as wealth accumulates over time. We all aspire to do better. You know, we're not gonna want to go back and just eat grain. So interestingly enough, you know, if you think back to the arable land base is shrinking, you can see what the demand curve looks like projected out to 2030. And what's interesting is if you look at it, you can see corn and soybeans lead in terms of increased demand, while wheat would be less and rice would be less. Again, that's the multiplier effect because corn and soybeans are feed grains, right? The demand is growing so dramatically for those because those are going to be converted into animal protein. But the net equivalent of this is if we were to maintain productivity at today's levels and just freeze it in time and say we're not going to get any better at what we do, we're going to need the equivalent of the entire landmass of the U.S. that we farm today to meet this demand. It's about another 250 million acres are going to be needed in order to do this. If we totally blew out the Cerrados in Brazil, we could probably get there. I don't know environmentally from a sustainability standpoint that's how we'd want to go about this task. So again, it just says leveraging the technologies that we have available to us and making the existing landmass more productive is probably the best way to solve the problem. So it's interesting, you know, in terms of the business that we're in as Monsanto, we're about making farmers more productive. That is the business that we're in, and primarily through higher yielding seeds. And it's interesting when you talk to farmers, I had my feelings hurt a little bit because my undergraduate degree is in agricultural economics, and I heard economists getting beat up on earlier today. But that's okay. I'm a pretty sensitive guy, but I'm getting over it. But when you talk to a farmer and you just listen to them describe their operation, they don't use economic terms, but what they're telling you is their goal in life is to be on the absolute bottom of the marginal cost curve. That's what they aspire to. They want to absolutely minimize cost per unit produced. Why? Because, you know, while you can market your crop in a band, you're largely a price taker. I mean, they're commodities, right? So, you know, whether corn's $5, $3, you know, or $2.50, the way that I stay in business over the long term is to maximize production and dilute out my fixed cost. And so, you know, farmers don't buy down, as you know, in tough economic times. In fact, they look, you know, how they can become more productive. And what this slide just basically shows is just how much leverage there is on yield for a farmer. You know, they do want to buy well, but they cannot save their way to prosperity. They have to yield their way to prosperity. And so that's basically the business that we're in. And, you know, every year when we come out with new, better seeds, we can, you know, create that value and share that value with farmers. But that is the core business that we're in. We spend about $1 billion a year, employ about 4,000 PhDs to basically help farmers become more productive. So basically, one of the things that we set out to do, I mean, given the task that I've laid out here, is a commitment to sustainable agriculture. And basically what we've said is we want to double the yields of our core crops by 2030, and do it by utilizing a third less resources per unit produced, okay? And again, the way you do that is you increase productivity, higher yields on the existing landmass, and when you get more bushels of grain per acre foot of water, per ton of fertilizer, okay, you are consuming less per unit produced. So basically, if you think about how we're going about the task, there is no single solution. It's going to have to be a multiple, you know, combination of tools to get it done. If you look at the base USDA yield curves, basically through accelerated breeding, we can make some significant gains. And by accelerated breeding, you know, what is that? We use molecular markers, so we have a very broad and diverse genetics platform. If you take corn, for example, over time we've acquired 36 different breeding programs from around the world. And the first thing we did is we just started making combinations that the world had never seen. So disease tolerance from Philippines combined with yield from the United States, you get better heterosis, you get higher yields, and we got significant yield gains just by making those unique combinations that hadn't been seen before. But the next thing we did is we put molecular markers into the plants. And again, I'm not a plant breeder, so the simplistic way that I think about it is, you know, it tells you where in the haystack to go look for the needle, right? I mean, if you take 30,000 genes in a corn plant and you make one random cross, the odds of finding what you're looking for on the first random cross is on the order of 1 in 2 trillion to 1 in 4 trillion, okay? Which is about to be equivalent of making a cross and finding the one ear of corn on the one stalk of every acre in the United States that had what you were looking for, okay? So pretty random. If you use molecular markers and it tells you, you know, where on the genome to go look for what you're looking for, be it yield, be it disease tolerance, the odds of finding what you're looking for after about 4 crosses are about 1 in 5, okay? So very, very powerful predictive tools. And this will move in the future into comparative genomics, which, you know, is evolving in human science, and you'll be actually to be able to weed out, you know, or isolate for differences of specific genes between the plants. But anyway, it's allowed the acceleration of yield gain versus trend. Biotech obviously complements that as well. And the first generation of biotech tools basically have preserved yield potential. In fact, it's interesting that we saw an immediate pop when we introduced our first insect-protected corn. And the reason why is, if you think about a seed, right, it's as good as it's ever going to get the moment before you plant that seed. Once you put the seed in the ground, nothing but bad stuff begins to happen. Weeds try to outcompete it. Insects try to eat it. And so basically, when you can protect that seed and protect the full yield potential, and you don't get that lag or that drag effect of insects are eating it, we saw an immediate increase in yield. Increasingly in the future, with things like drought stress, and we'll be introducing our first biotech drought product in dryland corn in 2012, these are more yield enhancements or yield preservation tools, not just about dead bugs and dead weeds, but things like nitrogen utilization, how we use that more efficiently, how we preserve yield potential under conditions of drought are going to become increasingly important as well. But again, it gets to everything too. It's agronomic practices. Very simply, optimization of plant populations in a field. You know, that's still science that basically is emerging, and you know, some of the best work that we're doing right now is actually in Mexico, where farmers down there have learned how to optimize plant populations. But that science is still emerging basically in the United States. Things like seed treatments, where you can protect that seed before it emerges, are all things that can contribute to yield preservation over the long term. There's been a lot of progress made in terms of efficiencies. But interestingly enough, and again, this is a function of higher yield per acre, right? But interesting, if you look at wheat, it hasn't had the same effect as we've seen basically in corn, cotton, and soybeans. And a lot of that's just because of the level of investment that's been made in the three crops relative to wheat over the longer term. Now, we do expect, and there's many companies, including ourselves, that have begun investing in wheat more aggressively. But in combination with public institutions, one of the things that we've done is we've entered into some breeding collaborations with land grants. And basically, we will combine our genetics with land grant genetics. We'll pay a royalty for the use of those if we commercialize them. But again, it's all about creating combinations that weren't possible before. So if we do have a private genetic pool, by combining that with different genetic bases from U.S. land grants, we also have a collaboration with an Australian institution as well, we can make, again, combinations that the world had not seen before, which is an increase in opportunity and choice for farmers. Land grants can still commercialize everything that they were going to before. There's no loss of choice. But by combining it with our genetics pool, we can actually expand what those choices or opportunities look like over the long term. Precision agriculture is another area where there's going to be a tremendous amount of opportunity. And I would say it's evolving fairly similarly to kind of the first round of precision agriculture. If you think back to when, you know, the first precision agriculture applications were made, you know, one of the challenges was, farmers were looking at it and saying, look, I can use site-specific application technologies for nitrogen, and it costs X. Or with ammonia at 20 cents a pound, I can just put on another 100 pounds of ammonia, okay? The solution was less expensive than the tool. I think that's beginning to change now as farmers want to more carefully optimize what their yield potential is in a given environment. You know, the advent of yield monitors where farmers can see exactly on the go how yield is responding to a particular environment is a very, very powerful tool. And if you combine that with basically site-specific now fertility, you know, down to perhaps the half acre or acre, that will be the rate limiting step, but it's not too far before farmers will be able to have algorithms that will adjust their planting rates on the go based upon the environment they're moving through the field. Higher populations in your best areas, lower populations in your areas that don't have the same productive capability. You have the same fertility environment optimized for your higher yielding environments, minimized for your lower yield environments. So not only is it more profitable for a farmer to farm that way, okay, there's a nice environmental benefit that goes along with it as well. There's no sense putting nitrogen in the ground that the plant's not going to utilize, right? You optimize the fertility to the environment that you're operating in. And that technology continues to emerge. And I don't think it's going to be too far before we'll be able to see, you know, basically that automated adjustment on the go, and perhaps even down to differing hybrids, basically corn varieties in those different planter units. Again, based upon the environment from an optimization standpoint. So lots and lots of technology. And the point that I want to make is, you know, there's no silver bullet. It's going to be a combination of a lot of things and a lot of knowledge that's going to make this whole system work for the long term. So again, talked about you know, what it's going to take to get this done. And largely we've talked about the developed markets like the United States. But as we think about, you know, emerging markets, collaboration is going to be very, very key. You know, we don't live in a world anymore where the United States is going to export you know, and feed the world. Food sovereignty is very, very important to every country on the planet. Nobody wants to be dependent upon another party basically for their food supply. And so basically, you know, it's not just company to company, it's working with governmental agencies, with basically NGOs in order to get this done, in creating a common understanding of platforms in terms of alignment of expectations and goals. You know, there's sometimes a view that if you do good, you can't do well for your owners, okay? I would argue the exact opposite is that you can do good and at the same time do well for owners. And that's really important for a company like ours because we are a profit-generating enterprise. I mean, that's what we do for a living. And so if we talk to our owners and they say, well, why are you spending XYZ of my money basically on just altruism? Because if I wanted to make that decision, I should be able to independently do that. Give me my money, and if I want to donate it, I'll donate it. I don't pay you to do that on my behalf. Okay, that's very rational economic thought by owners. But if you say, well, you know what, let me tell you why it's in our long-term interest to do this, and it's going to generate more profits for you over the long term. Now how do you feel about it? Well, then I'm okay with that. And the great thing about it is when you enter into that kind of relationship, and when we're talking to a country that we're trying to help, for example, and they know that the reason why we're doing this is because our interests are aligned and I'm acting in my enlightened self-interest, I actually feel better about that. Because if I have to ask why you're here and this doesn't make a lot of sense to me, then it speaks to a relationship that's not probably very sustainable over the long term. So, you know, an example of a common goal is we're part of the Keystone Alliance. There's 40 companies that are part of this, and basically it is a focus on how we create sustainable development in emerging markets around the world. Another example, and this gets back to the self-interest, is water-efficient maize for Africa. Okay, those drought-tolerant genes that I mentioned to you that we're going to be commercializing in the United States in 2012, we have donated those to sub-Saharan Africa. Okay, and they're going to incorporate that into their corn hybrids. And basically, it could have 25-30% yield impact basically on these countries. You say, okay, well, let's do a little timeout, okay? You're going to sell it in the U.S. You gave it to Africa. Why would you do that? How is that in your self-interest? Well, if we can take people who struggle to feed themselves today, and you know, a lot of food aid, a lot of net importation of grain crops, but if we can help them become self-sufficient, if they can actually feed themselves, okay, the day after they can feed themselves, okay, they can sell surplus. And when they sell surplus, they generate income. And when they have income, they became a customer, right? Because I can sell them seed. But until they can feed themselves, I don't have any economic opportunity. So that's the absolute alignment of interest. And I can explain that to anybody, and they say, okay, I understand what you're doing. And you know what? I'm okay with it. Because you're going to help us. You're going to help us help ourselves. And then ultimately, down the road, I get that I may be a customer of yours. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. In fact, I think that level of transparency is something that's very, very cool. You know, everybody understands exactly what's going on, and everybody's acting in their combined self-interest, and it generates a lot of a real good alignment. So one of the things that we're doing to support innovation is basically we've pledged $10 million over the next 5 years to support graduate student work in rice and wheat breeding, which is core, obviously, to the meeting here and what everybody does every day, because we need to generate, if you look at the task at hand and what we're going to need to get done over the next 30 years or so, we need to have another generation of talent that's going to be able to basically pick up the mantle and help get this done. So agriculture is who we are and what we do. We're very committed to it, and again, you know, I guess I'll kind of finish where I started. You know, my only regret is, you know, I'm not in college right now, because as fun as this has been for the last 26 years, we're just getting going. I mean, this is, the demand is going to be absolutely huge. The need is going to be huge. And I guess the last thing that I think about, you know, and you know, we're not only fortunate that we live in this country, but, you know, that we've all chosen agriculture for a profession. Because if you think about what needs to get done, and there's lots and lots of ways to make a living, okay? There's not as many ways to make a difference. This is a way that everybody in this room can make a difference while making a living, and I think that's pretty special and it's extraordinary. You know, I feel very fortunate that I grew up on a farm and I have a passion for agriculture, and very pleased to see everybody here as well, and again, particularly the 1,000 students who are beginning to choose agriculture as their career. So with that, would entertain any questions?
Where do you see the leadership coming from that has the potential of aligning the self-interests? Or what needs to happen to create that leadership?
I think that leadership's beginning to emerge, and I think it's coming through self-organization, basically of interest. There's been a lot more activity. For example, the African project that we're working on, you know, you see some unusual alignment in that, you know, Gates and Buffett Foundations are partners basically in that project with us as well. So I think, you know, what's happening is a realization. As I said, there's no one company, there's no one entity that's going to get this done. I mean, if you look at the magnitude of the task, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, been lots of well-intended but misguided efforts over lots and lots of decades to try and solve this problem. And so I think there's a much more pragmatic approach that's emerging that recognizes what's happened in the past and what's going to take to get this done. So I'm encouraged, basically, by what I see.
Bert Gardwell, University of Minnesota. You spoke about the investment in graduate training in plant breeding. As you look at the global problem, both domestically and internationally, do you see a sufficient workforce that is properly trained and educated to achieve the kind of goals that you're speaking about in terms of doubling yields in the next 20 to 40 years?
I absolutely think, I think talent's going to be a challenge, I really do, which is, you know, why I applaud this organization. Because, I mean, you know, so first of all, it's just demographics, right? If you think about the average age of the American farmer right now, it's about 57 years old. You know, guys like me who grew up on a farm are a lot fewer. So there isn't the inherent pull, you know, the population base to repopulate all the ranks. You know, I mean, traditionally, you know, farm kids went to college, got degrees, entered industry. So what we have to do is basically, you know, sell this to people who are coming from non-traditional backgrounds and why this matters and why this is a great career worth pursuing. So we need to have talent pull acutely within this country, probably less so in some places like India where there's probably adequate talent to get it done. But I think that's a fundamental challenge because, you know, we've got to get a non-traditional population to think this is a career worth pursuing.
How important is a system approach for Monsanto?
As I mentioned, I think a systems approach is going to be critical. And it depends on what level you want to talk about systems. For example, you know, I mentioned earlier or at the beginning the announcement that we had today with the collaboration with BASF. One of the things that we've done to ensure that our herbicide-tolerant platform stays viable and robust for the future is two things. Number one, we will combine additional herbicide-tolerant traits like dicamba to provide, you know, more tools, basically, to control weeds. But the other thing that we've done now is basically in alignment with Extension is more robust herbicide programs, multi-modes of action. Incent the use of a second mode of action at the farmer level to prevent the emergence of resistance, but also then, if they do have it, to effectively deal with it by putting other co-herbicides in it. So one of the things that we've done is we've announced partnerships with many other companies that are basically agronomically sound recommendations, where farmers basically get incentives for using the right products to keep the technology more robust. And we've done the same thing in the insect control as well, multi-modes of action to decrease the probability of resistance. And the nice thing about those solutions is we will ultimately have a single bag solution where a farmer doesn't have to plant a structured refuge and can just go back to planting the way that they used to and basically have that refuge resistance built in to the seed, which is the best way to do it. So that's very narrow from a system standpoint, but fertility, proper seed selection, proper seeding rate, other agronomic knowledge, those are all going to have a need to have a contribution to basically the solution. It won't just be, here's the seed, do it. You know, there's going to be a strong need for agronomic knowledge along with that as well.
I just want to add to that gentleman's comment over there about raising talent. I didn't grow up on a farm, but I'm also in plant breeding as my major at Purdue University. And I did a couple internships with Monsanto Company, and actually they taught me how to drive a combine for the first time and let me in there. And I've got real-world farm experience doing an internship, and I think all the seed companies are really investing a lot in students, and it's just absolutely awesome. So I just want to add that.
Well, now I'm really jealous because they won't let me drive a combine, so. Yeah, you shouldn't have told me that. No, but it gets back to the talent, because one of the things that I mentioned in the collaboration that we have with some of the land grants on the wheat program, you know, we're going to put molecular markers in the university's genetics base and then basically provide the educational opportunities so they know how to use those molecular markers, and it benefits us and our next generation of plant breeders as well.
You use the term sustainable. When we go to lunch and go to these places across the street on the menus, and if you talk to the people around you, they have a whole different definition of sustainable. How would you reconcile those definitions?
I think that's like the meaning of life question. I think the shame is that it gets defined as either or. You know, there's nobody that owns the sustainable space. I mean, it doesn't have to be defined as sustainable equals organic. I mean, to me, is sustainable is how do you meet the needs that we're talking about here with the least impact on the planet? Okay, if that's the definition of sustainability, then using your most productive ground in the country and producing more output per acre is the most sustainable solution. Because the only other math, you know, we're all have to go back and farm, and we're going to have to clear a bunch of land to farm. I mean, that's the only other way to get it done. So, but I don't think it has to mean, organic's a choice I respect. I mean, if that's a choice that somebody wants to make, I'm okay with that. but just to feed the need that we have, it's just difficult to do it on scale if you don't use the tools of modern technology that are available to you.
No,
sure.
Go ahead.
You touched a little bit on the role of academia, you being the private sector, NGOs. What we heard Sunday night was the critical role of policy in setting signals. And you really didn't talk about the role of policy in setting the right signals, the right environment for this to happen. Do you have any comment on the role of policy in this?
Federal policy or? Okay. I an opinion, right? If you think about the greatest creation of wealth in the history of this country, okay, it occurred after World War II. Why? Because we had a bunch of soldiers coming home and we needed to do something with them, so we sent them all to college. Okay, it was the greatest creation of intellectual capital this country's ever seen. And I think if we want to do something from a federal policy standpoint, incenting that next wave of intellectual capital creation in this country is probably the greatest gift that we could do for the next generation. Now, it's easy to say how that gets done. That's way above my pay grade. So, I do think that that's something that would be beneficial. Particularly if you look at reinvestment in our land grants. I mean, you all know what percentage of your budgets you're now getting from your states, right? I'm on the board of my land grant, and I'm looking at those numbers every day, and it's going to be challenging. We've got to figure out how we reinvest in our infrastructure and basically create that intellectual capital. But, if you don't have colleges to send kids to, it's pretty tough to create the intellectual capital. So, long answer, short question, but I do think there's an opportunity there.
Yes,
one of the questions my students asked me is about the consolidation of the seed industry. The last 40 years, as you're probably aware, been a significant consolidation of the seed industry. What do I tell my students are the good things about consolidation?
I think it's the question of consolidation is it's just largely driven by economics. We spend $1 billion a year on basic R&D to make seed better. And that requires scale, basically, in order to do that. I don't know that there's any fewer opportunities for students from a plant breeding standpoint, but to your point, I mean, there is a fewer number of companies that exist today. That said, it's a highly competitive industry in this country. There's still over 200 independent seed companies that exist, along with a handful of companies like Monsanto that would be larger. I think that opportunity exists. And again, it's just the cost and the scale. We introduce a new product, it's about $100 million in 8 to 10 years that's required to do that. And you just have to have scale to be able to make that kind of investment. Thank you very much.
The loud voice that we need to be is in this society. On behalf of the American Society of Agronomy, we'd like to recognize you, Carlos Casale, as a distinguished scholar presenting the 2010 E.T. and Van York Distinguished ASA Lectureship, funded through the Agronomic Sciences Foundation. Thank you one more time.